This is theme music from a podcast series called The Lost Women of Science, launched a couple months ago. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The podcast series is part and parcel to a nonprofit initiative by the same name, working to recognize women scientists who, frankly, haven't gotten their due after making groundbreaking achievements in their fields. And through these stories, they want to inspire the next generation of female scientists. Can you think of a woman who has been overlooked for her scientific contributions? Are you a scientist or researcher with very few women peers? Why is that? Who do you look to as a role model? 800-642-1234. Amy Scharf is executive producer of the Lost Women of Science podcast series. She is a bioethicist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Amy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good morning. And we also have Katie Hoffner, who is a journalist and host of this podcast series. Katie, welcome to you.
Oh, thanks for having us, Kate.
Well, Katie, let's start with you and the work of this nonprofit. How did it form? How did it get off the ground?
Yeah, so we, and I hope Amy will pipe up here because she was so instrumental in the at the beginning of it. So Amy and I have been friends for several years, and for years, actually, she was telling me about this one woman named Dorothy Anderson who basically discovered the disease cystic fibrosis, and nobody knew about her. And we were trying to figure out how to tell her story. And then what was it, Amy, about, I don't know, a year or year and a half ago that we had the idea, let's start a podcast, not just
exactly.
About Dr. Anderson. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, it all really started about 8 or 9 years ago. I was at a party, and I always like to tell the, or relate that this really illustrates the importance of just stopping and listening and paying attention to the people around you. So I was at this party of a dear friend of mine, and I was sitting with her mother, who was at the time an 85-year-old retired pediatrician. And she and one of her friends was also a retired pediatrician, were telling me the story about this wonderful mentor that they had at the hospital where they worked, and who really served as such a leader and mentor and mother figure to them. Oh, and by the way, she also happened to discover the disease cystic fibrosis in the 1930s. Before that, it had been continually misdiagnosed and as other diseases, most commonly misdiagnosed as celiac disease. And this doctor, Dr. Anderson, who was a pathologist and in performing autopsies of children who had unfortunately passed away, she realized that this was a unique disease. And I thought, I've of course heard of cystic fibrosis, as have most people, but mm-hmm. who has ever heard of Dr. Anderson? And realized this is an important story that needs to be told. And enter Katie Hoffner, my friend and journalist. And we, again, talked for years about what was the best way to tell this really important story. And when we decided that it would be the podcast would be a great vehicle to do that, we realized as well that for every Dr. Anderson, there were probably another 100, if not 1,000 other women like her who made incredible contributions to science and engineering, but never got the recognition that they so richly deserved.
So many Dr.
Andersons. And we deserve to tell their stories as well.
Yeah, so many Dr. Andersons out there. And Katie, it's interesting to me too, is that you've really harnessed universities on this mission to unearth more Dr. Andersons out there and really find out who are we overlooking and even in creating a database.
Yeah, we have a database of now, it's grown to more than 200 women who, as Amy said, our guess was that for every Dr. Anderson out there, and remember, she did her work about 100 years ago, there are hundreds of women. So we're putting together this database, and here's the problem. The problem is that we only have 4 seasons per year, and we devote an entire season to one woman's, which is, and a season is 4, 5, 6 episodes a piece. So what do you do with those women who we might not have enough archival information about them? Because a lot of these women, they don't, especially, you know, Dr. Anderson was one of them, that the actual archival resources weren't there because her papers weren't saved. Mm. And that's the crime. That's just horrible. That, you know, we found one unfinished biography, a manuscript in a basement of hers, about her. And so the other thing we want to do, you know, we're not just a podcast, we're a full-blown initiative. So there are all kinds of facets to the initiative. And one of the things we're hoping to do is partner with Margot Lee Shetterly, who she was the author of Hidden Figures.
Mm-hmm.
Kate, I'm sure you've seen the movie.
Yeah.
And the book, I have to say, is better. And she's got something called the Human Computer Project. And so one thing we're hoping to do is fold that into the Lost Women of Science initiative and go out and find all these women, just like those three women who are featured in the movie. This is Margot's big dream. And why not dream big? You know, why not try to go out and find as many women as we can? That's the goal.
Well, let me reintroduce you here for just a moment as we talk with the co-founders of the Lost Women of Science Initiative, aiming to recognize women in science that have been historically overlooked. Katie Hoffner there, who is an author, New York Times contributor, and Amy Scharf with us, bioethicist. You can join in. Do you know a woman who hasn't been acknowledged for her work? Tell us about their science, their research, how you met them, what story you heard about them that caused you pause. 800-642-1234. Joanne is joining us from Appleton with a story. Hi, Joanne, go ahead.
Hi. I had a wonderful chemistry teacher at Holy Family Academy in Manitowoc, which was a convent academy, Sister Loretta Shimondel. And she, at the time she was teaching our one section of chemistry, she was also a nuclear medical technologist at Holy Family Hospital. And that wasn't even as amazing as what she did. Prior to teaching us, she was teaching at UC Berkeley, radiation at high altitudes, and she worked for NASA there when they sent the monkey into space. And then after she taught her 1 year of chemistry at Holy Family Academy, she went back to Berkeley and, you know, worked at there. And then in her semi-retirement, she went back to the convent to drive for the sisters. So, and then she was the most gentle and giving person. And she kind of mentored the three of us girls.
Oh, wow.
Would work in the evening in the lab, and she'd be there because we lived in the same building as the school.
Mm. Amazing. So how do you spell her last name? I'm writing it down now.
It's S-H-I-M-O-N-D-L-E.
And that's Sister Loretta.
Loretta.
Yes.
And she was a Franciscan sister of Christian Charity.
I wonder, Joanne, did you know at the time how... did you know about her background at the time, or as a high schooler, I wonder, did you just, you know, take her as a caring teacher and not really understanding just all of her contributions in that moment?
I did. I think we did realize that she had worked for NASA, and one wonderful thing that she did for our little class, she had been a confidant or mentor to Conrad Hilton. And he owed her a favor, and she called in this favor, and she asked if our small class could stay at a hotel of his. We made a trip to Chicago and stayed at the Palmer House for a four-day weekend for free.
Amazing. Okay, so I am determined not to lose this woman forever. So spell her last name one more time since I'm
at
6 o'clock.
If I can interrupt really quickly. We have a website, and on our website, which is
lostwomenofscience.org. You can, listeners can go to our website
and contact us.
Okay. You can enter in, send us an email and put all the information you have about your lost woman of science and what you want to share with us. And we will, of course, add her to our database and do as much work as we can to find as much information as we can about her and hopefully tell her story. So again, it's lostwomenofscience.org, and we hope to hear from so many of you.
Oh, Joanne,
yes, thank you, Joanne.
Yes, thank you for sharing that story. Katie Hoffner here, Amy Scharf, they lead the podcast series called Lost Women of Science, Unearthing the Stories of Female Scientists Who Have Previously Gone Unnoticed. Who do you look up to? What female scientists do you want to recognize? Did they get full credit for their groundbreaking scientific achievements? Did they get credit for those smaller steps along that journey? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a minute on the Ideas Network. Many women who made major scientific contributions are in the shadows. We're exploring overlooked histories of some of science's major innovators on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Lost Women of Science podcast series, it launched last fall. Here's the opening montage of the first episode.
Cystic fibrosis back then
was just considered a death sentence.
It feels like you're suffocating to death.
Dorothy Anderson.
She was the first to diagnose CF in a living patient.
She was down in the basement in Baby's Hospital doing these autopsies.
What are your favorite female scientists through time? What impact did they make on their field? What didn't they get credit for? 800-642-1234. Bioethicist Amy Scharf and journalist Katie Hoffner launched the podcast series and their nonprofit initiative, and they're with us for the hour. Let's bring on another call. Jean is joining us from Ashland. Hi, Jean. Who is on your mind?
Well, in 1979, I was finishing up my bachelor degree, and one of the instructors, her name was Helen Delabar, taught a research course, which was she was a very eccentric lady. She wore a wig and had many cats. Her wig was always crooked. Her clothes were covered with cat hair, but she taught me the most ever about research and told me that in her doctoral thesis, her project was with another nursing student out east to develop, they developed a nonstick Band-Aid using cellophane paper, and it was adapted by Johnson & Johnson. The students did not get credit because the project belonged to the university. When you're a student and you develop research, you don't own it.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's how the nonstick Band-Aid came about. Her name was Helen Delabar, and the sweetest little old lady ever.
And this was at the University of North Dakota?
That's where I went. That's where she was teaching.
That's where?
Yes.
And she was teaching, and this is in the late
70s? 1979 was the last year I attended that university. And she was a professor.
Oh, Katie, it sounds like there are Dr. Andersons all around.
Oh, yeah. Unbelievable. And so, Jean, please go up to the website, our website, lostwomenofscience.org, and put her name in, because, of course, I'll panic and think we'll never find her. She's probably died since then. But, you know, I just want to point out one thing, Kate, which is that a lot of these women became teachers. So the first caller, Joanne, was talking about her teacher, her chemistry teacher. And a lot of these women, they didn't have careers even available to them beyond teaching. And that's what they would do. And so they would then go and inspire an entire generation. And Jean, I'm assuming that Professor Delabar did that for you. You must have thought, well,
I'm going to get my master's, I'm going to work on a PhD. Oh yeah, she was just so stimulating.
Yeah.
And gave me the foresight to continue with my education. Yes.
Yeah. And Jean brings up an important point here with the nonstick adhesive bandage that universities oftentimes it's they who own the patents, and it is their name on these contributions to science, and maybe certainly not the students who are doing that work in the lab.
Right. Well, you know, that's peculiar not so much to gender, but to the way universities work. But what's really interesting is whether there were any nuances to that, like whether there was gender discrimination that was sort of on overdrive because she was a woman. That's an interesting thing to explore.
Amy, I'm wondering, you know, as we think about teachers and their influence, UW-Madison, Alice Evans, who really did some pioneering work on pasteurizing milk, started as a rural school teacher.
Yes, she did. And we were so excited to be able to learn more about her. She has, as in many of our scientists were teachers. And in fact, like we have some wonderful scientists coming up in future episodes too, who also served as teachers. And many of them, because they couldn't get positions in scientific firms or in universities or in businesses, they became teachers. And fortunately, scientists like Alice were able to still pursue her science and her passions as a teacher, and also to pass on her love of science and her knowledge to her students.
We're talking. Yeah, Katie, go ahead.
Yeah, if I could jump in about Alice Evans, you know, she. So we had so much fun preparing for this show, Kate, because, you know, we're a national podcast, but when we heard we were going to be on Wisconsin Public Radio, we thought, okay, let's find as many Wisconsin scientists as we can.
you scraped so, that database for Wisconsin.
Oh, amazing! I mean, that's the thing, is that there were so many women who started out either at the University of Wisconsin-Madison or are from Wisconsin. So Alice, she was a microbiologist. She studied bacteriology in milk and cheese. So it's almost, you know, one of the things that we look at a lot is how women managed to, a lot of women were food scientists, chemists. So home economics, which sounds like, oh, you learn how to sew, not at all. That was back then, it was all, a lot of these people were chemists, like serious chemists. So, so here she was, she got her, she had a lot of skepticism aimed at her because she didn't have a PhD. And then this is an amazing thing, is that in 1922, so we're talking exactly 100 years ago, she was infected with one of the diseases she studied, which was called undulant fever. The fact that we even found her, I think, is quite amazing. She's been in our database actually since the beginning. She took a job at the U.S. Department of Agriculture in the dairy division, and she was the first female scientist to hold a permanent position there, which is quite amazing. So go Wisconsin.
We're talking with Katie Hoffner and Amy Scharf. They are founders of the Lost Women of Science Initiative. Amy, there's something called the Matilda effect. As you look at these women and who gets due credit, how prevalent is it for men to get credit for the work of women in science?
Unfortunately, it is extraordinarily prevalent, especially in anything that the 19th and beginning and, well, most of the 20th century. To give credit to actually the coining of the term the Matilda effect, there was an historian, Margaret Rossiter, who in her extensive and exhaustive compendium of women scientists in America initially coined the term the Matilda effect. And I'm going to allow Katie to talk about actually how it got the name the Matilda effect. But it is really quite prevalent that colleagues of women have gotten the credit. We've all heard and know the story of Rosalind Franklin, who was instrumental in the discovering the double helix structure of DNA, yet Watson and Crick got all of the credit, including the Nobel Prize. And she was sort of left to the dustbin of history for quite some time, but fortunately her story has been told. And our goal is to elevate the other women just as Rosalind has been elevated. And Katie, I'm gonna ask you to give some more background on the Matilda effect.
Yeah, so Dr. Rossiter, who spent 50 years doing this work. She has a huge 3-volume set of books on the history of women, of female scientists in America, starting in the 1700s. Anyway, Matilda Joslyn Gage was a suffragist.
And I want to, I just want to pause right there because we're going to pick this up on Matilda after a news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring the stories of remarkable women scientists who have been overlooked. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The podcast series is called The Lost Women of Science, and we have the women behind this initiative. According to Pew Research, women in STEM occupations vary widely. Women make up a large majority of the health-related workforce, but women remained underrepresented in other sectors like computing and engineering. Are you a woman in a traditionally male-dominated field, like math, like the physical sciences? What has your experience been like? Have you received due credit for your achievements? Join in 800-642-1234. Journalist Katie Hoffner and bioethicist Amy Scharf with us for the hour. Okay, so we left off on Matilda Joslyn Gage, who was a writer and activist in the 1800s, pioneering suffragist. How does Matilda's story inform this work, Katie, and the lost stories of remarkable women?
Right. Yeah. So Matilda, amazing. If you don't know about Matilda Joslyn Gage, I'd like to advise that you run, don't walk, to your Google and look her up. So she's been called a woman who was ahead of the women who were ahead of their time, part of the suffragist movement in the 1800s. And she she's the one whose name is used for the Matilda effect. So Dr. Margaret Rossiter, this historian of science, was trying to name this phenomenon, like what should she call it when women don't get the credit for something that they've done, that the man gets the credit instead. And it's a pretty widespread problem, and it happens to this day. And she decided to call it the Matilda effect, just to honor Matilda Gage, who wrote a pamphlet called Woman as an Inventor back then, you know. So, and was obviously very, very early in looking into women who invented things, women with a scientific bent. So that's the phenomenon. It's when a man gets credit for what, for work a woman has done. It's also, it's subtle. It can be nuanced. It can be hard to kind of dig out. So we found it in Dr. Anderson's story, and we're finding it now as we do our second season, which is about a computer scientist who, and we were having this lively debate, a couple of the producers and I, with someone we were interviewing about whether Clara von Neumann, who we're looking at for season two, actually should have been a co-author on a paper that was seminal to the field. And it's an interesting question, like how is credit given? Because it's from the credit that legacies are born, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so part of your work then has to really be detective work and putting a lot of pieces in yes. archives, very piecemeal, kind of shaping, putting a story together.
Right, well, that's where, you know, my, you know, 100 years as a journalist have really come in handy. We spent with season two, with season one, we were down in basements looking through boxes and working with colleges and universities around the country where Dr. Anderson studied. And then in season two, we've been at the Library of Congress. So there are 55 boxes, that's 9,000 documents of not Clara's papers, but her husband. So he was the very famous mathematician and computer pioneer named John von Neumann. And her papers are basically thrown in with his. So it was a total kind of needle in a haystack detective work that we've been doing for season two.
What was interesting about Dr. Anderson, I thought too, Katie, at one point in the podcast, you're just like, we're not done telling her story. There was more here. There was more that you wanted to get out. And right. I kind of, it caused me pause because there is always more in a story. There, you could keep going on and on. I mean, there, it seems to me that the story doesn't end. I just felt at that moment like, well, I didn't walk in her footsteps. I wasn't there. There are things that we just won't ever know. But I'm wondering if you could give us a fuller sense of what that feeling is like when you're trying to make sure people understand just the impact that Dr. Dorothy Anderson made to the world.
Oh, and it's an amazing impact. I mean, Amy, you should chime in here too. I mean, she think about it, but people were 100 years ago, these parents were absolutely panicked because their children, they were being diagnosed with celiac disease because, you know, when you think of cystic fibrosis, you think, oh, it's a lung problem, but actually it really involves in a terrible way, the intestinal tract. And so these kids would get diagnosed with celiac. So then their diets would get changed and then they would die before they were a year old. And so she figured out that it was a much more complicated problem than celiac. And, you know, celiac disease is, that's what spawned all the gluten-free aisles in the grocery store. That's celiac. And so, she then figured out that there was, and this is where the Matilda effect came in. She figured out that there was involvement with the sweat glands. And so children with cystic fibrosis, all you had to do was kiss them on the forehead. And if it was super salty, then she would know that was cystic fibrosis. In fact, there used to be a saying, if your child's breath, this was in the 1800s, if your baby's brow tastes salty, then that child is cursed and will die within, and is cursed to die soon. And so, but people didn't understand the underlying pathophysiology of what was actually happening. And so she developed this diagnostic tool, which then became the sweat test. And so part of the Matilda effect, as we were teasing it apart, was who gets credit for making the connection between sweat and cystic fibrosis. And it turned out to be very complicated. One of her mentees is credited with the sweat test. But the question is who really made the link first? I know. And so that's how the sweat test, by the way, is still the main way of diagnosing cystic fibrosis.
And her legacy continues because having isolated and named cystic fibrosis, the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation and other support organizations sprang up, and due to them and their advocacy work and emphasis on research, there have been terrific therapeutics that have been developed in the field of cystic fibrosis, one of which came on the market just a few years ago. It's called Trikafta, and it has been a game changer. Literally, it's not an exaggeration to say it has been a lifesaver for many cystic fibrosis patients. And we can all thank Dorothy Anderson for this.
I just want to reintroduce both of you as we talk with the creators of the nonprofit and podcast series called Lost Women of Science. Amy Scharf there, executive producer, Katie Hoffner, the host. You can join in 800-642-1234. Madeline is with us in De Pere. Madeline, who is on your mind?
Oh, I had a question. Did that also happen to Albert Einstein's wife? Was she also a physicist? And she was the first one to actually have the breakthrough, but he got all the credit.
Madeline, yes. Thank you. Yes, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, Madeline, thank you for bringing that up. It's such a good question. Yes. Go ahead.
No, his wife, and I am blanking on her name, she was a physicist, and they did study together in university and in graduate program, and she did, I don't know if she ever completed her doctorate, I believe because she became pregnant, but she was instrumental in his work, and there are many theories that she was instrumental in his developing theory of relativity and other scientific breakthroughs.
Mileva Marek Einstein, is that it, Katie?
His first marriage was to this.
Oh, okay.
Was to Mileva. I think what we're talking about Elsa. His second wife. I'm not sure. You know, it's a very fraught question about Einstein's wife, and I've wanted to stay away from it, mm-hmm. Because it's has sparked so much debate about what exactly that was. Mileva was the first wife, and apparently Mileva had the scientific chops, if you will, of her husband. And then Elsa was the one who sort of was, you know, less active. And more, she was kind of his manager, his agent. I don't know about Mileva and how much she actually did. What an incredible story.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one that I've actually steered clear of, because everybody there, you know, all of the evidence has been looked over many, many times. And so with the podcast, and the series and the whole initiative, I'm really looking for news stories that have yet to be uncovered. And, it's an interesting one, the Einsteins.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the podcast series called The Lost Women of Science. The women behind it, journalist Katie Hoffner there, bioethicist Amy Scharf. What efforts have you seen to rediscover people who have gone unrecognized for their accomplishments? How should institutions retroactively recognize people who have been overlooked? Still time, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. They're women trailblazers who changed science and didn't get credit for it. You're with us for The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The podcast series is called The Lost Women of Science, born out of a nonprofit to uncover the stories of these remarkable women scientists. Are you a woman in the sciences? What or who made your career possible and enabled you to succeed? What do you want women considering a career in the sciences to know? Still time, 800-642-1234. Katie Hoffner and Amy Scharf, co-founders of the Lost Women of Science Initiative, with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring in Becky now in Houstonford. Hi, Becky. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. The name that I would put forward is Emily Deschutelet. My pronunciation is awful. I can't speak French, but Emily, Emilie, D-U, Chatelet, C-H-A-T-E-L-E-T, who was a mathematician, physicist, scientist to the extent that she could. She was of the economic class where she was able to build a laboratory of her own. And she, shall we say, became a close friend of Voltaire, but she was never recognized for her advances in mathematics or the scientific experiments she did, and she died an untimely death after childbirth. She was the one who came up with the mathematical process of multiplying an object's mass by the square of its velocity, and that mathematical advancement was instrumental in Einstein's eventually being able to come up with E equals MC squared.
Well, Becky, thank you for bringing her to the fore here and really, I guess, taking this type of project, Katie, to an international level.
Right. In fact, and getting back to the Einsteins, Mileva Einstein and her contribution, you know, this is, I hope I can figure out a way to formulate this succinctly. One of the real questions, and the, I just want to pick up on where I was talking about the Einsteins, is we have to be very careful not to elevate people, the women, when they shouldn't be. And part of our mission is to tell the true history. So that's why I stay away from the Einstein controversy. But Du Châtelet sounds fascinating, and I didn't know about her. And you know, this is where calls like this are so important to get. And please go up on, I'd love for the caller to go up on lostwomenofscience.org and put that in the submission form or send us an email at lostwomenofscience@gmail.com, because our database can only grow. And one of the things we want to do with the initiative is exactly what we're doing today with you, Kate, is kind of crowdsource this. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, get people to hear about it and call in and go to the website.
Brainstorm.
Give us and brainstorm collectively as a nation. And what you just said, and internationally as well. I don't know how on earth we're going to do that, but let's just start with, you know, the 50 states, right?
Amy, how
started
do you...
this project had it not been for hearing sort of offhand the story of Dorothy Anderson?
Right. Bringing it full circle. Amy, how can scientific institutions, universities do a better job of recognizing the accomplishments of women? What would your advice be?
Oh, well, that's that would be the secret formula. I think part of it is really to, first of all, just make sure that girls enter the STEM pipeline and persevere through it, and to have a greater representation both amongst students and faculty of women in the STEM fields. We're talking about all engineering, mathematics, science, the whole gamut. I mean, as you know, universities traditionally women were excluded from attending. There were, of course, colleges for women in the United States, but for the most part, there were very few, and the large research universities were closed to women until really mostly their late 60s, early 1970s. So there's a lot of catching up to do. In fact, there really has to be a reckoning among the universities. In fact, one scientist that we're looking at who we may feature in an upcoming season applied and was accepted for a PhD program in mathematics at a top research university, but she applied using only her first initial because she knew she would not be able to get in if she used her full female name. And once she was accepted and was ready to matriculate, she let them know who she was, and it didn't go so easily for her. So stay tuned.
Katie, women of color also face a much greater burden in order to get credit for accomplishments in the lab. How do you find those stories and try to piece together what has happened there when you look at racism?
Yeah, it's such a good question. I mean, it's the you know, backwards and in heels question. I mean, my goodness gracious, we have quite a few, you know, we're really committed to finding women of color. And we've, amazingly enough, we've unearthed quite a few. And we're probably going to devote a season very soon to one of these. And and Amy, I think this is right. Historically, Black colleges and universities have really good archives that that we'll be digging into to find more of the stories.
Amy, right. I imagine.
And exactly. And
yes.
These colleges and universities, some of them were very focused on science and engineering and really produced a rich, rich group of graduates, men and women, who in the sciences and engineering fields.
Katie, you've been writing about science and computer science for decades now. Have you seen progress in women being recognized for their achievements, or are we stalled out?
Yeah. No, there is. There's a great amount of progress in some of the fields. I think if you were talking at the very beginning of the program, Kate, about how the numbers are starting to creep up, but in computer science, for instance, which is the subject I've been covering for decades, it barely budges. And so that's one of the big sticking ones that we really need to work on. There's a wonderful program based out of Northeastern University called the Center for Inclusive Computing that got a huge grant from Pivotal, which is Melinda French Gates's new philanthropic organization to fix things in computer science, to get girls and women going into computer science.
You need the numbers in order to affect that change. Amy, how about you as a bioethicist? What progress have you seen? Where are we at?
Well, if you look at in the field of medicine, women and women physicians and women researchers really have made enormous strides. Mm. I think if you look at just enrollment in medical school, it's very close to 50-50, if not more, 50% women. So that has really been a terrific achievement. I mean, that said, there's still a long way to go if you look at leadership among hospitals and research institutions in the medical field. I am sure the majority are still the top leadership is men, and so there is that the glass ceiling there. But I think with more and more women entering and succeeding in the field of medicine, we will achieve that leadership parity.
Well, thank you both for joining us. Amy Scharf, their executive producer of the Lost Women of Science podcast series. Katie Hoffner, journalist and host. You're listening to the Ideas Network.